introduce Thorkild Sørensen. He's a professor of theology at Copenhagen University. He's worked with historians and economists and many different kinds of people to try and understand the obesity, emergence of the obesity epidemic, so-called, in Denmark, using many different kinds of approaches. And most recently, he's been contaminated by anthropologists. and I don't even know the title of today's talk, but you're going to be talking about the kinds of databases and how you approach the emergence of obesity in Denmark.
Thank you. Assuming that most of the audience will be there tomorrow, so I try to avoid too much of that. First of all, I'd like to introduce the institute where I'm working, a little bit about myself, for you to understand my approach to these things. The IPM means Institute of Preventive Medicine, and this is adjacent to the like the hospital department. It's not a university institute, and so it's economically, administratively, regarding staff, etc., responsibility. It's run like a hospital department, and I'm actually chief physician of that department. and it's belonging to one of the university hospitals in Copenhagen, the so-called Bispebjerg Hospital, which is one of the greater common hospitals, but also the hospital with university obligations and tasks. And this institute actually began as just a letterhead, because there was a young American psychologist who had heard that it would be possible to do population-based longitudinal research in Denmark, which I understand still is a great challenge in the United States. So he wanted to come to Denmark, and he had some connections. He met with another young fellow who was just appointed as the head of psychiatry at the old hospital in the middle of the city where our institute actually physically located, although we administratively belong to another one because the physical location is now converted to a university campus. this guy, his name is Sarath Metnik, and he is now in his late 70s and he's still very active. They have been fortunate now in America, as you probably know, to have no specified retirement age, so we take advantage of that. And he's still coming to the institute, and he wanted at that time to set up a study, which I think is quite elucidative of the activities of our institute, and which also may be relevant to the discussions of the collaboration we might have here. He was interested in what was coming up, emerging before schizophrenia really breakthrough. Obviously, the breakthrough of clinical schizophrenia is a disaster, it's a very dramatic thing, but it's also clear that something happens maybe stepwise or continuously until the real breakdown of the personality. So his idea was to do a longitudinal study of a group of people who were at high risk of becoming schizophrenic and to see if he could observe what preceded the breakthrough of schizophrenia. And what he did was he wanted to investigate kids born to schizophrenic mothers. Of course, they had a predefined, already known, that was known at that time, high risk of subsequent schizophrenia, much higher than the randomly selected individual from the population. So they started this study, they found mothers, they found the kids, they started investigating these kids, and this study is in fact still running. So this was in 1962. So this is now, how many years is it? 47 years since they began. And now Sarath is considering to do something very unique in the psychiatric field, as I understand it, I'm not a psychiatrist, to study the aging process among people who have a predisposition to schizophrenia, who might have had the breakthrough of schizophrenia as well. So he's actually applying for NIH grants to investigate the aging of a high-risk schizophrenic population. And there may be some interesting relationships there. So this is just illustrating the institute. The institute had a different name for the first 30 years. It was called Superlogisk Institute. And that's an interesting background of this, because when he came to Denmark and he got these money, they didn't like to see these money pass through the hospital administration. And then NIH could not give the money to them to a private bank account. So what they did was they made the two guys made a letter with the name Psychologisk Institut, director Sarah Metnick, co-director Felix Schulzinger, you know, made really nice, like the letters we get from the lawyers, and then the address, and then they typed in that here is a bank account from this institute, please transfer the money from NIH to that account. And this was enough for NIH at that time. So they got the money, and the institute was founded that way. And then they built it up. And for the third 30 years, there were no basic resources at all. It was all based on soft money coming in and out, and they were in and being spent. And then, of course, it's an up and down for the third 30 years. Then when Finn Schulzinger, the psychiatrist in Denmark, when he decided to retire, he wanted to see his baby, this institute, survive his retirement. And so he went to the authorities in Copenhagen and asked them whether they could possibly have a little bit of basic support. So he got half a secretary. And then also the allowance to have this institute converted to an institute in the Copenhagen Municipality Hospital System. And then when he retired, I was really lucky to get his position as director of the institute. And since then, we have broadened the perspectives, as you understand, to include a lot of other things, particularly somatic health problems. And the status of the institute is very nice. It's just one paragraph number two, which just states that we're supposed to do research in health issues, period. and that makes life pretty easy for us. It's not specified in any way. So we fight for this, and we see if we can survive the modern administrative organizational political turbulence. Okay, so that was a little bit about the institute. And what I can tell you now, we have about 50 working places. So this is a mixture. It's going a little bit up and down. It's students. It's bachelor master students, PhD students, postdocs, senior researchers, statisticians, IT people, etc., etc. I mean, usually the usual composition of a staff of a medium-sized dry institute. My own background is that I'm fully trained a doctor, a clinical clinician. I worked first in surgery, decided that was not for me. I went to internal medicine, become specialist in internal medicine, further specialized in liver disease. And I had obesity as a kind of underlying leisure time interest. And this came from my very first employment as a resident in the Department of Surgery, where they in the 70s wanted to do intestinal bypass surgery. Now you probably know that you have a new surgery to treat obesity. There has been another one that after some years disappeared because of too many complications and problems. But at that time, the head of the department where I was, they planned to do a big trial testing this new type of shortening or bypassing the intestine versus conservative treatment. They wanted to test two different types of bypass type of surgery. And then they put the question, and that was what brought me into obesity. They said, well, first of all, I had asked them, I understand it's a good idea to do some research as a resident. So could you find something I could possibly do? And they were kind of smiling at me because I was supposed to do surgery all day, all night, etc. But then they said, why don't you try to find out how frequent and how dangerous obesity is? Because the only thing we have is the old, very large North American life insurance statistics, which actually have been built up over almost 100 years. I think the first one came in the last part of the 19th century and was going up with several and more expanded statistics, ended up in a very big volumes called the Built Blood Pressure Study and the Built Study. And that was about what they had at the time. So they wanted to have new Danish data rather than old American data. And they asked me, why don't we try to approach the insurance companies in Denmark to see if you can generate such new data? I tried. I couldn't get through. I tried three times, and they didn't like to see a young resident in surgery entering into their files and archives. So I gave up. But at the same time, I was called for military service. And suddenly it struck me that obviously we have hidden weight from all the Danish young men who were mandatory examined for military service. And I went back to the old archives and found out that this kind of information was actually kept for a large part of the country, for actually for several hundred years for height measurement. For body weight, the first year was, in fact, during the Second World War. This was done in 1943. From you from Britain, this may sound very surprising, but you may or may not know that Denmark had a kind of a special status during the Second World War. The Danish government was still running, even though the Germans had occupied the country. There has been, of course, a lot of political debate about this approach to the German occupation. There was some resistance movement, it was increasing, but the government tried to keep things at a kind of modest, non-destructive level, in contrast to what happened in Norway, where they really were fighting against the Germans as new events. But Denmark was kind of a running society, and the Germans had an interest in that also, because Denmark was producing much more food than we could possibly eat ourselves. So we served as a food chamber for the Germans. They just took the food and gave it to themselves. And then after the war, we have been reimbursed for a little of this food. I don't know how much, but that's a funny thing of the story. And then also relevant here, because that means that the supplies to the Danish people during the Second World War was nothing like in Norway. In Norway, for example, they really suffered from famine. And in various ways, food was coming from Denmark to Norway during the Second World War. So in that way, it was very different. And the fact that the Danish government could actually take people in, to young men in, and examine them for military service is a very strong indication of the ongoing society despite the German occupation. I think the Germans were primarily interested in food and then building the defense system along the west coast and keeping the control of the sea between and the access to the Baltic Sea, something like that. Now, I can tell you my own father was actually in the military in 1942. Of course, they were not fighting; they were just there. In August 1943, the things broke down. There was what is that called in English? I mean, people were protesting. There were fires in the streets, etc. And the people just had too much. So August 29th, 1943, the whole thing broke down, the government resigned, and the Germans took over, then it went on until, of course, the liberation of Easter, the help of the Allies. And that, of course, also stopped the mandatory examination from the death ward. So I had data from 1943. And then people were very, very busy examining these a young man went after the liberation in May 45, and they were so busy that they skipped weighing, unfortunately. So they wanted to have all the young men who should have been examined in 44 and in spring 45. So they rushed through, and also in 46 they were still so busy. So they resumed the weighing in 47. So I had actually a little jump from 43 until 47, but since then it was ongoing, and it's been ongoing all the way through. My own data, which I will present tomorrow, which is part of this history of linguistic theory, goes all the way up to 1977, I mean the examination year 1977, but it goes on after that. It's possible to continue this process, and we have done part of the work in the continuation of that. So that's kind of a historical exposé of how I entered into this, and it also tells you a little bit about what kind of data we might have access to. During the work, I realized that there was also kept old school records from health examinations in school. So I started to look for them. Where are they, and what are they used for? Nobody was really interested. At one stage, there was a plan to destroy them all, And fortunately enough, that was not me, that was the guy at the Cancer Register, realized it might be a very valuable information. So they were saved from destruction and put into a common archives. And now they are very well organized, and so they are running from birth year 1930, that means school year 1936. And that system continued uninterrupted during the Second World War, and it went on after that. Unfortunately, in 1984, there was some kind of economic depression going on in the public sector in Denmark. So they reduced the activities in the schools, and they only measured height and weight at the school entrance and for most of the students when they left school. So we only have data from entrance and leaving school from 1984 and upwards. And now they are reconsidering, because of the event of obesity, they are reconsidering to install the continuous monitoring of the kids with annual measurements, so they really can see where they are taking off in body weight. So I found out I could possibly work with them, after having been through all the draft boards, I identified the most obese ones are some 360,000 people. We went through manually. You can imagine how terrible, boring that was. But eventually, we ended up with about 2,000 extremely obese collected between 1943 and 1977. And then we took a random sample to have a really good picture of the underlying population, about the dopant size. And then we came to the school records, and we linked them up with the school records because we could do that with the name and birth date. And then I decided that it was necessary to computerize these school records, really to get a good understanding of the obesity epidemic. So I got permission to actually computerize all of them with the information I needed for the research. And that activity started some 25 years ago. I was able to raise a few grants now and then to continue the process a little bit stepwise or in small chunks. But now, eventually, after we got the bigger grant some years ago, we actually were able to complete computerization. So we now have personalized identification and birth weight and annual measurement of height and weight and time of the measurement in months from 6 to 14 years for 360,000 school children, all based on this staff helping me computerize it. And when you ask me whether there's some additional information, I will immediately tell you, so you don't ask me, that every time you suggest one single digit to be added to the computer files, you should imagine that a person, a staff, or my one person, my staff, should sit there and do this at least 360,000 times. So that made me very conservative in terms of what should go into these registers. We have then realized that there's a wealth of information in the old school records, and therefore we have taken this case cohort, case listed cohort approach. So if you identify a group of school children which is suffering from something interesting, we take them, we go back to the original school records, and we computerize what information is relevant. That could be obesity, it could be several other things. We actually have a group interested in infectious diseases right now, in vaccinations, what that means. And then we take the random control group, and we go back to the random control group, and we computerize the information there. And actually, this random control group is much bigger than the usual case group, which is a pure statistical efficiency. And then we're also doing as complete as possible. Of course, there's a lot of text information in these school records, which is difficult for us to computerize. But then we are making indications whether there is such text information, and when one can go back. At one stage, we have plans to make screens of the school health records, but for various reasons we haven't been able to get through that. But it works nicely because we have permission to get direct access to these old files. So our students we hire to do the work, they can go out there and they still do this. We have a little group of students who are still computerizing both the old register and these subsets. So This is another part of the story, and it's been extremely fascinating to get this record and to get this register up running. As you can imagine, it's very rare that anybody has systematic population-based data on children from 1930 and onwards. So one of the things we, for example, have done is we've published a paper on birth weight and subsequent mortality, which covers a longer time period than anyone else has published. This is almost the whole life, from birth until about age 70. And for the draft board, we can do the same. We just submitted a paper on the long-term prognosis of obesity throughout life, from the inter-adult life at the mandatory draft board examination, age 19, 20, until they are approaching 90. So this is really the value of this kind of longitudinal type of data. We have a whole program investigating the long-term effects, health effects, and there will also be social factors here in play of obesity in childhood. We can follow these individuals, and we get back to this when we're talking about the register information. We can link up this and get all the information in completely in electronic form without approaching the people. So this was a little bit about the obesity epidemic and how I approached this, how I got into it, and about the institute, about my son. Then I wanted to tell you a few things about my views on obesity and imbalance. I don't think I have too much time to do that tomorrow. It's only 20 minutes talk tomorrow. But I'd like to tell you that I'm very, very skeptical about, and I know that Stanley listened to my talk in Nottingham about that. I'm very skeptical about translating the classical physical law of thermodynamics, the energy balance idea, to the understanding of the epidemic. I mean, I think one should be extremely careful in order to take the physical thermodynamic law, which of course is valid. I mean, I don't think I am in a position, maybe you are not, to challenge the physicists' understanding of thermodynamics. I mean, as I understand, it's still valid. There's fundamental relationships between energy in, energy out, and we actually had an opportunity to take based on my memory of my own school, so to say, but in the part of my study, the second thermodynamic law, which is interesting because it costs some type of energy to establish a structure. And then when you, for example, burn the structure, that means, for example, tissue, you cannot recover that part of the energy. So the energy balance in, out, equal change or stability doesn't fit when you have used energy to establish a structure. And this is described in the second thermodynamic law. Please don't ask me about the third one, because this is becoming very complicated. I haven't found use of the third thermodynamic
law. Can you remind us what the third law is?
Yeah, this is something very complicated by another view about energy. I can't remember the details about it. If I should get into this, I needed to read about it, get in touch with a physicist and talk to them about what does this mean. It's very complicated. Okay. One of the crucial things is that this law, the first one, which is the one usually referred to when people try to explain the development of obesity both at the population level and at the individual level, is that it's taken for granted that it is based on manipulation of changes, externally based changes, externally related to the process, so it can come from the brain, for example, in intake relative to output. So this is the idea that is behind it, that the manipulation is on the left side of the equation, and that there's no activity, there's no primary activity related to the storage process of energy. And I think this is a fundamental misunderstanding, that you don't allow yourself to think about processes that, where the body, for example, for some reason, maybe some of the things you have been building, I just read all the papers, you have built in your hypothesis about the stress. I mean, if the stress goes, changes something in the brain, this stress may as well work on the storage process of lipid. The release of lipid as well as the uptake of lipids in the fat cells directly. It does not necessarily need to go through appetite or food intake. If you have an increased storage, net storage in the fat cells, then of course for the body to continue running and respecting the thermodynamic law, you need to increase your food intake a little bit, corresponding to this, or reduce the expenditure a little bit. And then the second thing that happens is that when you grow, you will not only grow in storage, you also grow in metabolic active tissue. So you need to eat a little bit more. So the people saying that obesity obviously is dependent on huge amount of extra food intake, there's a lot of papers trying to calculate this on the societal level, individual level. They are not addressing, in my view, carefully enough what comes first, what comes next. Because if you accumulate fat, you also build up the body storage, the body metabolic processes. You demand more food in order to serve this metabolic process, and therefore you eat more, much more than is stored, taking time-wise. And that means actually that you observe that when people are obese, they obviously need more, they eat more, just to keep the machinery running. And that part of the disentangling of the causal processes here is what I really is missing in a lot of these ideas about what is behind the obesity epidemic. And I think it's very important because we need to understand the steps in the causal pathway to identify the proper way of targeting, of stopping the epidemic or even reversing it. And if we are taking this is a usual concept, and I think this is also part of your foresight report. I know Susan Depp from Cambridge very well. She was on this panel to make this foresight. The whole idea of the foresight, if I understand it right, is really based on this need of extra energy. And pushing in of extra energy. And the needs of extra energy is considered, the same applies actually to the public American views of this. The needs of the energy, extra energy, is then seen as a condition for the obesity. That means that if you take away the opportunity for the body to get this extra energy it needs because it's big, then you are removing a condition for perpetuation of the obesity, and therefore you might see a stop in the increase, and you might see a decline in the body weight. But I think this is wrong.
Specific.
What?
Yeah. Be more specific.
Yeah, come on.
Take away the need. What do you mean by that?
I'm not explaining it clear enough. What is built into the obesogenic theory is that people are obese because they have access to too much food and they're tempted to follow this for whatever reason, to take this food. Okay, what they take in can be decomposed into two things. One is that it serves their body's needs because they're already fat. The other part may be a tiny little unmeasurable part that actually adds to the development of obesity. Okay, if you have the obese people and they need this extra and you take away this food, you some way restrict their access to food or whatever level, then of course they cannot satisfy their body's needs of extra energy. Then they are forcing them into negative
energy. And their existing body size.
Is needs the right word here? This is not really needs, this is body demand, as it
were. Yeah, okay, maybe my English is not proper.
No, but this is...
It is a consequence.
Terminological...
Yeah, very important, very good. It's very helpful you clarify this here. It is the consequence of the fact that the body has already grown. So the tissue is there, the metabolism is there, the metabolism requires the energy. Whether this is called needs or demands, I'm not sophisticated enough.
Can I try to be more precise about this?
Yeah, okay.
What you say sounds to me a bit like the concept of metabolic rate. So, obesity raises the metabolic
rate. Sure, it does.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that.
That's essentially what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, but not only basic metabolic rate. It also raises the energy demands to move the body.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's heavy.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's tendency to reduce
her as well, because what? They have more obesity, more muscular as well.
Exactly, this is my point. And all this lean tissue, all this non-fat tissue is metabolically active and have a metabolic rate. So this is what I'm talking about. Okay. Good. So this was a little bit about the critical view on this, and the fact that the position I'm taking here allows me actually to approach theories about why we are obese, why we have the epidemic, completely independent, completely detached from the restrictions of the anti-balance theory. So this is what I like the freedom, having been through this and this, written, I think I sent you the paper, allows me to think completely independent of the anti-balance, and this is what I like. Okay, so this was also addressing this obesity causes a higher rank of net. I mean, obviously we need to understand where, when we have this accumulation process going on, we need to think about where, what kind of hierarchical cause of net is behind that, ending up in your theory, for example, about the welfare regimen. Of course, this is very much up at an abstract level compared to this biological process of increased storage of fat. But I think it's very important to see the connections between these various levels from this very abstract level all the way down to the process of storage. And I think you have outlined in your papers for this conference that one pathway could actually be the stress, the chronic stress, depending on the development of the society, which I think is a very interesting idea. Now, let's jump then to what Stanley really wanted me to tell you a little bit more about in detail, and this is about the the register information we have. It's clear from what I already said that we have a lot of registers, and there's a long history behind these registers. I cannot tell you in details and specific why we have such a society. Maybe this is part of your historical approach to the welfare regime hypothesis. But at least we have them. They are there, and they can be used, and they have been in use for several years. And and it's important to realize that we have two types of registers. One is the national registers, which can be conceived as administrative registers, just as a tool for society, the public sector, to run. So it's been built up stepwise as it has been realized by the public sector in Denmark that for administrative reasons, it's a good idea to put all this information in one national register.
Is this data linkage? I mean, are these records that have been computerized in different government departments and all of this is linked up?
Yeah, this is all put in Denmark Statistics, which is, like a Fort Knox.
But like the Education Department, Health Department, Census, you could find one individual in these different records.
Sure. Yeah. That'll come back to that. Yeah.
I think an important point, you mentioned this in passing, is that the data are themselves part of the problem. The data are generated by the problem.
Absolutely.
We see this.
Absolutely.
Yes. And so, for example,
the national one.
Yes, so for example, why did they start weighing conscripts in 1943?
It was not a part of interest in obesity. No.
Because, on the contrary, the conscripts are underweight.
Yeah, many
were. It was a problem of underweight, and so they become aware of
it. And also, they were concerned about, the strength. I mean, not only the height, I have been told, is very important in the military. I mean, to find out which kind of duties you have in the military depends on your height. And then obviously it was realized by the changes in how the military works that the body weight might also be important. I don't know the history, but it would be interesting.
I would focus on food shortages. Suddenly there isn't enough to eat, and they worry whether these people are fit for military service.
Well, that's not true for Denmark. There was no indications that we were were lacking food during the war. That was one of the reasons why I mentioned that in the beginning. We actually compared this using a good indicator of the general food supply in the Nordic countries. So we have a paper investigating the height among children in all the Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, Norway, I think Iceland was there also, and Denmark. and exactly examine what happens before, during, and after the Second World War. And for Norway, as I mentioned before, it's very clear they were really depleted of food. So you saw the height of the kids going down, and then, of course, resuming normal levels afterward. And for Finland, it was also slightly, but not as bad as in Norway, even though you might think that in Finland, because they were in this very special situation with the Russians. Sweden, there was almost nothing, and also Sweden was neutral. I mean, Sweden was running completely kind of independent of the war, so to say, that way. But Denmark, there was almost nothing either. Okay. So there is a lot of information. Then also, it has been custom to computerize, of course, research-based studies. And this is what I have been doing. And many of my colleagues have been doing in Denmark. So they, when they see the opportunity, they make these big registers. I can tell you about some other ones, and those are just mentioned later. And now it comes to the linkage point, because this is I'm jumping here to the CPI number. Before we go to the CPI number, I need to tell you a little bit about the linking conditions of working with these data. Where should I start? Of course, there are regulatory systems set up to protect confidentiality, to protect personal integrity, etc. And the current situation is extremely favorable to doing research based on registers. I don't think there's any country in the world where it's so easy to get this kind of information. Our colleagues and brothers in Norway, they have much more difficulties. Sweden have about the same. But my impression is that for various bureaucratic reasons, it's a little bit more difficult in Sweden. Finland is probably the one where it's almost as easy as in Denmark. I haven't heard about any other country in the world where you can actually do the same things as we can do. And so this is also where, since we are so few people and we have this enormous exploitable resource of information, we are very happy to collaborate with people from outside, from abroad, because obviously we are too few people needed to take advantage of all this. And so there's a lot of activities going on based on collaborations, not least with your country, the UK, people from the UK, but also very much so with Americans who are coming over with their ideas and their brands and their staff, and then we're exchanging, etc. So that works very nicely, and it's of course extremely inspiring for us to be get into these collaborations. the leaking conditions, I need to tell you a few extra words about this, because I don't know whether you're aware of that, but the EU actually made a directive which is supposed to be installed in all the laws of all the member states, a directive that regulates access to personal information. They obviously needed this. They needed it because it was a prerequisite to open the market in the very general sense between the member states. So in order to have the flow of services, the flow of labor force, the flow of money, across the borders of the member states, they needed to have a very, very clear rules to protect individual information, personal information. And when they came up with this, I think it was the 90s, I can't remember the exact year of the first directive, it was very clear to us in Denmark that if this directive would be installed and put in force in Denmark, it would immediately destroy all our research opportunities, simply, just from day one to two, because of the constrictions in access to register-based information. So you can imagine that we did whatever was possible, those of us in Denmark who were involved in this, to change the directive. And we used all different kinds of tools to convince the department and the commission in Brussels that they need to make special clauses allowing us to continue doing this kind of research. And of course we were arguing that this is very valuable for the society.
Which year was this?
I think it was in the beginning of the 90s. But that is kind of a stepwise process. If you were interested, I can get back, because I was heavily involved at the time, and I kept all these over. or somewhere. I don't know the exact years, but it was, I think it was in the early 90s. But what happened was, and at that time we were alone. Denmark with 5 million people in Europe was alone in this, because Sweden was not a member yet. They were negotiating. Norway was negotiating. They eventually decided not to go. Finland was negotiating, not a member state. Then we were arguing that the same activity would be destroyed in these other countries if they become members. And of course, they were extremely concerned, our colleagues in Sweden and Finland. But it didn't help in the Commission. They said non-member states have no influence on how these directives are made. So that meant that we even had to force more fiercely against this. And we, of course, used whatever tools we could possibly do. It was a guideline, not a strike, but I don't know. Getting against some kind of machinery that's looked almost impossible to fight against. But what clearly helped was that we mobilized the patient organizations. For example, I was in Brussels talking directly to the woman who had written the directive, together with a representative of the European Heart Associations. And that had a dramatic effect. Before we met her, she had received, based on our initiatives, multiple protests, also from America. I mean, we were thinking about rockets in the back of the Atlantic hitting Brussels. So she was extremely scared about this. Why is this directive such a bad thing? She couldn't understand. So we had a nice opportunity to explain to her what was really wrong. And of course, we had prepared well. So we came with proposals of each escape clause that should be put in. And this kind of activity was going on from many different angles. And it ended up in a new version of the directive, allowing us to actually continue our research, but one, we needed one removed. And then the Minister of Councils was assembling in Germany. Germany was heading the Council of Ministers, and the Danish, and this was for the internal market. This was considered as an internal market affair, as I mentioned. The Danish minister was sitting there. This was a very charming woman who was responsible. And we prepared her the best possible way to set to her, you must have this sentence removed. It's very, very important. And we were so happy about it, because usually the politicians don't listen to us. But she took that with her to Berlin. And then they were sitting there, all these guys. And the chair said, well, okay, now we are this directive. Any concerns? Can we close the case? And then this Danish minister, this woman said, well, I have a little, I want a little change. Is that really necessary? I mean, no, none of the other ones could really see the utility of having this thing changed. Then she was smart enough to ask the chairman for a break, a timeout. We were following the process from home. And then, fantastic, she went around, convinced a majority of the other ministers around the table, personally, please, for this reason, go against this rule. Give me this. Let us change it. Then they reassembled, and the chair again said, now, any objections to this? Well, it seems as if we need to change the sentence. So it was changed. And they called back. We got it. And after that, the law in Denmark was changed. So the law was then made even easier for us to move and work with the rest than it was before that. So in that way, we are very happy. And the positive attitude of society among the government, whatever government, we have a right-wing government right now. We have had the Social Democrat for several years before that. They all have a very neutral, very positive, very supportive attitude to this kind of activities. So there's been even further improvements. One of the things is that now we are not requested to have ethical approval to work with the Red Surveyor. That was needed before. If you're not getting in contact with people and taking blood samples and things like that, then you don't need the ethical approval. You can even send them questionnaires without ethical approval.
Can I just ask you, to what extent are there international protocols around this? Because I know that in Australia they're
granted data on the kitchen canopy also.
Okay.
And in Scotland also.
Yeah, I heard the Scotland and moving fire, yes.
Yeah. So are there sort of common protocols for this?
Well, actually, I don't know whether, in terms of collaboration between the governments and
no,
setting up the rules.
Things you can and can't do, what you can and can't do.
I can't answer that, sir. I don't know. I have observed that in Scotland they are far advanced. They're almost at the level of Denmark now, mm-hmm. in terms of this register-based leakage opportunities. The final argument, I don't know how helpful that would be in your settings, but and not least after this, these CDs that were lost were data on 25 million Brits. I mean, that gave you a back, what is it called, backlash? Or I mean, that was not good. But the argument we have persistently used, and it seems to work among the politicians, is, tell me, we say to them, tell me about a single case where a researcher got access to register-based information for research purposes, and this access ended up in a misuse of these data, causing any sort of damage to any one person. Nobody could come up with any single case of that sort. And every time it's raised as a kind of a virtual fear that this is a very dangerous thing, every time this is said, then we just repeat the question. Tell us about a single instance. There's no one. And you can even use the argument, I have used that in debate with ethicists, you can use the argument that if you go on the other side, if the researcher in some way go on the other side of the fence and start misusing this information, it's not a researcher. It's a criminal behavior. And therefore, this person, whether this was originally a researcher, it's now somebody who is just doing something they're not allowed to do. So that argument worked quite well. Okay.
I just wonder if we could, complete in 5 minutes?
Because I think we've been through this and this, and now here is an important part of the story. And this is that in 1969, we had what is called the Census Person Register Number installed. That means that everybody living in our country, April 1, 1969, they got a unique number, which is the first six digits is the birth date, and then there are four digits, which is unique, and you have odd numbers for males and even numbers. The last digit is odd for males and even for females, and there's a special rules that can be checked that this is the correct numbers, and this number is used everywhere in the society. It's used by the taxation community, it's used by the banks, it's used by the shops, it's used by insurance companies, the health system, everywhere in the private and public sector. It's linked up with our transfer salaries, etc. So the number is extremely useful doing what you asked for before, making the linkage. Because if you have one data set with a number and another data set with a number, you just merge the two things. That means you have an automatic transfer of the information on these persons from one register to another. And this is what we have been using extensively. And now, finally, I'd like to tell you a little bit, very briefly, and we can go back to this if it's useful for you in your project, that there are a very long list of national registers, as I said. And this list is not comprehensive. It's just what I have been more or less involved in using. And some of them I don't know that much about. Of course, a lot of this is papers. All the old papers are more or less are stored, more or less complete. We've talked about that already. Of course, there's a lot of demographic information on the registers. I mean, when you're born, when you're baptized, when you're married, etc. When you're divorced and married again, and then when you eventually die. So we have all the demographic information, and also when you are moving from one site to another, which is very interesting. I mean, when you're moving from one municipality to another, the address is updated with not more than 2 weeks delay. So you always know where people are.
You register, do you have to change your register at a new location as in Germany?
No. It's all done electronically. It's a one big database.
Yeah.
So it, of course, if you're moving around, your address is always updated. And also there is, which we think is very important for our research, there is a link between mother and child. That means that if you have a person here, then the register tells who is the mother and who is the supposed father. Of course, there can be some problems with the identification of the father.
It makes a census redundant, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's no census anymore. Yes. Not really. There has been. I mean, this is a historical information. Yeah. You want to go back, you have censuses, yeah. You have police registers, you have church registers, and most of this is on paper.
So essentially you have an up-to-date, complete demographic...
information until just a few days ago. Because it's running, and also because the whole society is so dependent on having this in function for all these other activities and services. And then we have a cause of death register. Of course, we have cause of death certificates from very old ones back to the 19th century even. But the computerized register is from 1942 and onwards. So we have all deaths in Denmark computerized from 1942 and onwards. This one was 1969. And then we have a psychiatric register, which was becoming stepwise complete during the 1950s. And now it is. And this is kept separate from the somatic hospital registers, which I come to. This is this one. I think they have some plans at the National Board of Health to merge the two things. So all hospital admissions in Denmark, and I think it also applies, I'm not sure about it, to the private hospitals. We have very few private hospitals, although it's growing now. And there's a lot of debate about what is the relationship between the private hospitals and the public hospitals. But I think it's fair to say that almost all hospital discharges, whether alive or dead, is in this register. And the register tells you from what date to the next. It tells you which department. If you move between departments, it tells you that. If you have some kind of surgery done, it tells you that. It tells you discharge diagnosis up to 20 different ones. And it's all coded according to the current ICD codes. So all this is there, and this is since 1972. I'm not sure about that. And then we have a drug prescription register, which came later, and this is to do with the reimbursement of prescribed drugs, per-pocket reimbursement of prescribed drugs. So this all goes into one register. This is more difficult to access, and this is a kind of an exception that requires special rules. You can only put your data, you can link them up, you can only have the handling of the data within the walls, so to say, of the Denmark statistics. You cannot take the data out to yourself, which we can with the other ones. And it's later. And the politicians was concerned about what kind of information could come out of knowing which prescriptions they had. Then we have the health insurance register, which tells you that each consultation with the GP is also recorded, because the GP gets his money based on this recording. And there's a coding system for this, which is much less detailed than this one, but it can be helpful. This one here. And then, of course, we have the birth register, which I think goes back to 1970, which includes all the basic information about births and some basic information about the mothers as well. We have an employment register, which runs a way that if you that every month you are employed by any one institution, company, public, a little fraction of the money, the salary, goes to a special pension fund called ATP. Arbejdsmarkedstillægspension, what how could I translate it? The labor market's additional pension. So this is a process ongoing, and to administer this, you need to have information from each employment, wherever it is, in public settings or else. So this has actually been used by various researchers to get an employment history and examine employment history and relation to the risk of diseases. We have also, which I haven't used yet, information about basic education. This is all.
When does the employment history record begin?
That one I can't remember. I think this is from the, I would guess it is also something about the 1970s.
Okay.
and the education register is telling about the schooling, and then of course income, because the taxation authorities need that, and all the kinds of social support. I haven't used these myself, so I don't know details about it. But I know all this is in Denmark statistics, institution run by the government, supported, and the government is heavily dependent on it, because the information flow from this institution to the lawmakers is, of course, very important. And we can actually have a contract with Denmark Statistics, possibly access, and some of my colleagues did work with this, where you have a remote access. So you have the people sitting in our institute, and then under specialized conditions they can access the data, but they cannot take the data out. They can work on the data in Denmark Statistics under these specified conditions, so they have signed a contract, and then they can get the output onto their screen or whatever analysis. And in Denmark Statistics they have installed programs, statistical programs, etc. This is a new development, recent development, because before we had to sit down in the basement of this huge building under rather poor circumstances, but then there was a new political discussion about research conditions, ending up in having this remote access based on a individual project-specific contract, which I think may be useful if we get into some collaboration here about information that might be very relevant for your ideas, but I haven't worked so much with it so far.
Okay.
So that's about it.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, thanks very much. Yeah.